Welcome to Let's Just Talk. I'm your host, Hami. Today, we're joined by Mu'in Rabbani, a researcher, analyst, and commentator specializing in Palestinian affairs and the contemporary Middle East, to discuss President Trump's recent statement on forcibly removing Palestinians from Gaza, or call it ethnic cleansing. Mu'in, welcome to Let's Just Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for being here. Well, without further ado, since Inauguration Day, it seems like each morning brings news from the White House, or like a new headline from the White House, that feels more dystopian and detached from reality than the last. But the fact remains that this is reality. And I want to start today's conversation by getting your reaction to Trump's statement that at the conclusion of the fighting, we have a ceasefire, so a lot to unpack there as well. But at the conclusion of the fighting, that Gaza will be owned by the United States and turned into high-end real estate, while Palestinians are to be ethnically cleansed to Egypt and Jordan. And he made this post just sitting 2 feet away from Netanyahu, the person responsible for it all. So what's your reaction to this before we jump into the rest of the questions we have for you today?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack there. And let me just start by saying, if there's one thing that characterizes Donald Trump is that he's a very erratic and very unpredictable politician and leader. And so trying to determine, what his statements actually mean, particularly looking also at the connection between what he says and what he does, is a little bit like trying to do a political analysis of yogurt or oatmeal. It's very difficult to do so. So let's backtrack a bit and look at the idea of the mass expulsion of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. And of course, many in the U.S. Democratic Party are now trying to pretend that the first time this has ever been put on the agenda was by Donald Trump, and that therefore those who refuse to vote for Kamala Harris are somehow responsible for this proposal. Well, the mass expulsion of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip actually goes back many, many decades. And it is originally an Israeli proposal. And if I can just give a little bit of historical background here. Gaza City, as you probably know, is one of the oldest cities in the world. It's where, Samson in the Bible bought the columns, the columns crashing down upon me and upon my enemies, or as I say in Arabic, عَلَيَّ وَعَلَى أَعْدَائِي. But the Gaza Strip didn't exist before the mid-20th century. And the only reason the Gaza Strip exists at all is because of the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe of the late 1940s, especially 1948, but it actually began in November 1947 and continued until the early 1950s. What was the Nakba? Well, the Nakba was the forcible mass expulsion of Palestinians from those regions of the British Mandate of Palestine that became the State of Israel. Israel, through violent force, armed force, transformed what had been an Arab territory into a Jewish state. It's often referred to as ethnic cleansing. And here I need to point out that ethnic cleansing consists of two components. Pushing people out is part one, and preventing them from coming back is part two. And you need to have both those elements. So what Israel did is, many of those who it dispossessed in southern and southwestern Palestine, particularly from what had been the Gaza district of the British Mandate of Palestine, which was much larger than the Gaza Strip, these were all pushed into a narrow coastal strip of land, the southwestern corner of Palestine, comprising a mere 1% of the territory of the former British Mandate of Palestine. That's how it got the name Gaza Strip. Its population, its pre-war population, had been 80,000. About 200,000 dispossessed, pauperized refugees ended up being driven into it during the Palestine War. And then it was essentially sealed off so that none of these refugees could return to their former homes that were typically within walking distance of the Gaza Strip. And Israel, from the very outset, recognized, and I believe it correctly recognized, that having this mass of dispossessed, pauperized, irredentist humanity just across its borders, within spitting distance of their former homes, as I pointed out, would form a permanent security threat to the new Israeli state, because these were people who would try to come home by peaceful means, through nonviolent means, and once they would understand that that was not an option, quite logically, they would take up arms to repossess their former homes and homeland. And that's, in fact, exactly what happened, because Israel refused to comply with its international obligations to enable these people, whom it had transformed into stateless refugees, to return to their former homes. So, beginning already in the 1950s, Israel put forward various proposals and initiatives to remove the population of the Gaza Strip, or at least much of the population of the Gaza Strip, and particularly the newly refugee population in the Gaza Strip, even further from Palestine. So it put forward proposals to exile them to Libya, to the Anbar province in Iraq, to various other places, all with the idea of reducing what it refers to as a demographic threat sitting right across its borders. And it's important to recognize we're talking here about almost immediately after the establishment of the Israeli state, and about the period of 2 decades before Israel's occupation in the Gaza Strip began in 1967. When Israel occupied the Gaza Strip in June of 1967, it continued with these proposals. It at one point had a scheme, an agreement with the neo-Nazi dictatorship of Stroessner in Paraguay, to exile tens of thousands of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to Paraguay. It forcibly expelled a few thousand Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, along with their families, to the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt, which at the time was also occupied by Israel. About 250,000 West Bank and Gaza Strip Palestinians were dislocated during the June 1967 war, and Israel prevented them from returning to their homes. And in fact, the population, the June 1967 population of the Gaza Strip, did not recover its levels as a result of these measures until the early 1980s. This is something that's often overlooked. So you had all these proposals. And then in the 1980s, mainstream Israelis and Israeli elites appeared to have concluded, that this was, given the changing world and new standards of humanitarian law and scrutiny by the international community and so on, Israeli elites and mainstream Israelis came to a fairly broad conclusion, that what was possible in the 1940s and the 1950s was no longer possible, and largely put this ambition of the mass expulsion of Palestinians aside, and it became kind of the preserve of the Israeli extreme right, an increasingly powerful extreme right, to be sure, but it didn't really bleed back into the mainstream as a serious policy, particularly so after the Oslo Accords of 1993, which, for all its faults, and those were very many and extremely serious, did make provisions for the return of several tens of thousands of Palestinians to the occupied territories. Then you have the Palestinian attacks of October 2023. Israel responded with a kind of genocidal hysteria and frenzy to these attacks. And almost immediately, the mass expulsion of every last Palestinian from the Gaza Strip was back on the agenda. It was on the agenda of the government, it was on the agenda of Israeli elites, and it became once more a mainstream position within Israeli politics and society. And already that same week, you had increasingly vocal and public and explicit proposals that all these Palestinians have to be expelled, this time into the Sinai Peninsula, into the desert, into this territory that Israel had relinquished occupation of and returned to Egypt as a result of their 1979 peace treaty. The difference this time is it wasn't only Israel making this proposal, but it was embraced by the Biden administration. And the Biden administration sent its Secretary of State, the hapless Antony Blinken, on a tour of the Middle East to basically market this idea to Washington's closest Arab partners, let's call them its client regimes, to generate their support for it and to get their assistance in its implementation. And much to Blinken's surprise, the Arab states who were most loyal to Washington and are most dependent upon Washington categorically refused to have anything to do with this. And it was for a very simple reason. Of course, they disagreed with this policy, but more importantly, the ethnic cleansing, mass expulsion, the Nakba is so central to contemporary Palestinian identity, and is so central to Arab perceptions of the question of Palestine and of Arab solidarity with the Palestinians, that the complicity of any Arab leader with such a scheme would be tantamount to political suicide. Any Arab leader who would publicly agree to implement such a plan might as well sign his own death warrant. So that got nowhere. And in fact, in response to Trump's latest proposal, Egypt has now come out and basically confirmed that both the United States and a number of European countries were openly encouraging Egypt to cooperate with this Israeli scheme. So it again fell off the agenda, if you will. I mean, Israelis kept talking about it and promoting it, but they focused more than on two things: on the mass displacement of Palestinians from the northern Gaza Strip to other parts of the Gaza Strip, and more generally into making the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation so that people would eventually leave by hook or by crook rather than through an organized mass expulsion to Egypt. Fast forward, and Trump, who to his credit is actually the one who succeeded, not so much where Biden failed, but succeeded where Biden and Harris refused to go by compelling Israel to accept the ceasefire agreement that Hamas had agreed to more than half a year earlier. Trump engineered Israeli compliance or endorsement of this proposal. And then out of the blue comes this crazy idea of not only the mass expulsion of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, but their dispersal to Egypt, to Jordan, to other places. And on top of that, the US taking ownership of the Gaza Strip and sending troops to implement this plan. Again, it's difficult to kind of sift fact from fiction, from fantasy, let's say ambition from policy, from just off the cuff BS. My suspicion here is that, as you may remember, in early 2024, at an engagement at Harvard University, the slumlord and failed real estate developer, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had proposed something very similar. Although, in Kushner's telling, because he had seen how Blinken fell flat on his face a few months earlier, in Kushner's telling, Israel would force all the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip, but rather than to Egypt, to basically concentration camps, in the Negev Desert, in what is now southern Israel. It would do whatever it needed to in the Gaza Strip, and then the Palestinians would be not go to their former homes, but be pushed back into the Gaza Strip to resume their lives as stateless refugees, and presumably, to work as waiters and prostitutes in the luxury hotels that Kushner Associates and the Trump companies would have built there in the interim. So, Trump, by contrast, initially said that these people would have to permanently leave rather than temporarily, that U.S. armed forces would be used, that the U.S. would own this. I don't even want to get into the legality or morality of any of this because it's so obvious it would be a waste of our time to even get into this. But I think there's several things worth pointing out about this proposal. First of all, you can't really expel people who you haven't militarily defeated. And Israel, for all its mass killings and genocide and systematic destruction of the Gaza Strip, it has managed to destroy everything in Gaza but Hamas, everything in Gaza but the will of the Palestinian people not to surrender and to continue resisting Israeli hegemony. So, will the US military succeed where Israel's mediocre military has failed? Well, by all accounts, we'll never know because this is something Trump has already backtracked on, primarily because of opposition from within his own base, who, as you know, includes substantial constituencies of isolationists and anti-interventionists, people who have come to see the Democrats as opposed to the Republicans as the war party. It used to be, of course, the other way around. The second key thing that happened is that this time the Arab states came out publicly and forcefully against the proposals. And people keep looking at the US-Israeli relationship as well, they should. But for Trump, the other key, perhaps the key relationship in the Middle East, is not with Israel, but it
Saudi
is with
Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. And given that Trump, in the press conference you're referring to, additionally was asked, has Saudi Arabia insisted on a Palestinian state as a price of normalization with Israel? Trump responded that the Saudis had not insisted on this. This really alarmed the Saudis, and they actually put out a press statement at 4:30 a.m. Saudi time, rejecting Trump's proposal categorically out of hand, and insisting that there could be no Saudi-Israeli normalization without a Palestinian state. And in fact, the main impact of Trump's proposal has been to raise the price of normalization. He's made it that much more difficult for Arab states to enter into relations with Israel without getting something very tangible in return. But having said that, mass forcible expulsion has again been normalized and put on the agenda. And I think the broader, to just to conclude, two broader points that should be understood about this. First of all, it's part of a concerted, systematic, orchestrated campaign to transform the question of Palestine from a fundamentally political issue about the right to self-determination of a people, of a dispossessed and occupied people, to transform that into a humanitarian question. In other words, the problem for the Palestinians is not their denial of their right to self-determination. It is not the Israeli occupation. It's jobs, it's food, it's housing. Pretty much the way Western states looked at the Palestinians between the Nakba of 1948 and the emergence of the Palestinian guerrilla movements in the wake of the 1967 war. You may remember that UN Security Council Resolution 242 and 338, for example, don't even refer to the Palestinians by name. It refers to a
The
just
Arabs.
resolution of the refugee problem. In other words, we need to deal, these refugees need to be given a home, need to be given a job, need to be given an education. But it's not an issue really that has any political and certainly no national political dimension. So there's an attempt to retransform it into a humanitarian issue. And I think that is quite dangerous, obviously. The other point is that once again, Palestinians are not even being consulted about this. Yeah, of course, Trump says everyone he's talked to f instantly fell in love with this idea. It's like saying Beauty and the Beast fell instantly in love, because it's quite clear, people have gone out of their way to reject this, but in his little fantasy world, of course, Trump will say that everyone loved it. But the point I'm trying to make is that no one consulted the Palestinians, because of course you don't consult Palestinians about their future. You consult Israelis, you consult Europeans, you consult Americans, and then you propose a future for the Palestinians that primarily serves not the Palestinian national interest or even the interests of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but rather Israeli and Western interests. And now you have this crazy David Friedman, the US ambassador to Israel during Trump's first term, basically saying that the Palestinians are begging for this proposal to be implemented. And then also, once again, the idea that you resolve challenges facing the Palestinians not by ensuring them their rights, certainly not within Palestine, but by removing them outside of Palestine. So the whole proposal is dead in the water. It's stillborn. It's not going to go anywhere because it cannot be implemented. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that it is. Is that really going to change anything? I mean, we have a historical record here. In 1948, over three quarters of Palestinians who resided in the territory that became the State of Israel were expelled and were not allowed to return. Did that create peace in the Middle East? That simply meant that these Palestinians took up arms from the territories to which they had been expelled, from the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank, from Jordan,
Jordan,
from
Lebanon.
Syria, from Lebanon. And exactly the same thing would happen if this proposal were to be implemented. It would solve nothing. Certain, well, it would solve nothing for Israel.
Yeah. Thank you so much for eloquently outlining how this statement fits into the broader trajectory of both Israeli policy but also Western interests. And there is so much to unpack. It's hard to know where to begin, but we have to point out the cognitive dissonance that exists when the president of the United States, we who are responsible for funding the destruction, the mass killing of Palestinians, then tells the person who implemented those policies that they're going to remove Palestinians from their land because the place is uninhabitable and because it has real estate value. And it's like you don't even name any of those things, but you gaslight the masses into thinking that they're crazy for thinking that what you're saying is just bananas. And, we must also ask the question, why does he want the land, right? And, people, commentators have been pointing at things like the Gaza Marine Fields, which are worth, like 1.6 trillion
You're
cubic
talking about the
meters.
natural gas deposits off the coast.
So people have been pointing at things like that. Analysts have been talking about the fact that Netanyahu promised the eradication of Hamas. And now this is Trump's way to give him face to go back to Israel and tell the people, we're going to get the Gaza Strip one way or another. So let's just keep going through with the various phases of the ceasefire deal because they're in phase one now. But essentially, this plan kills any prospect of a ceasefire if it were to go through. And then interestingly, you've pointed out at the you've started talking about the client state, the Arab states that are hand in hand with, both the West, the United States, Israel, And I'm more or less quoting you here, along with like other scholars like Rashid Khaldi, that without understanding the inertia and complicity of Arab state, you cannot fully appreciate the question of Palestine. And so, there were reports that when Blinken was going up to Sisi in Egypt, he was open to the idea, but the military was just like, this is going to lead to a complete collapse of the Egyptian regime. So I'm wondering if you could say, just this could be an episode within itself. But I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about what you and scholars like yourself mean when you talk about the complete collaboration of Arab states when it comes to the question of Palestine and how they give lip service to the issue, to the masses and to their people who tend to be pro-Palestinian, but in terms of policy and action, or should I say inaction, there's a lot of that going on. And the last
Yes.
point I will make is about Democrats, and the lip service that they're giving to this, because Trump is the one saying it now. And for the past year, we watched them unilaterally support anything that the Biden administration has done, along with our European allies. And so that also raises another question for me. It's like, you're okay with the slaughter of 18, 20,000 children, however the number it is, but you're not okay with ethnic cleansing. Like, it's just not, the math is just not mathing in my head. So please,
Okay, well, I'll take each of your points in turn. Just regarding the first part of your question, I don't think this is about economics. Yes, there are economic resources. Yes, it is beachfront property. Yes, there are natural gas deposits off the coast of the Gaza Strip. But that's not a prime motivation for Israel. I mean, it may be for, Kushner or Eric Trump or whatever. But for Israel, this is really about hegemony. This is about establishing Israeli political, territorial, and demographic supremacy, hegemony over the entirety of Palestine, maximum land with
Minimum
minimum
Palestinian.
Arabs. So that's a first point. Regarding what you said about the ceasefire, you're entirely correct. I mean, this mass expulsion and the ceasefire agreement are mutually exclusive. They're fundamentally incompatible. And it, as you know, it was a sight to behold to watch Trump talking about Gaza has been completely destroyed, while saying so right next to the person who was primarily responsible for its systematic destruction, who had a smile from ear to ear while listening to this, because Trump, rather than pointing to him and saying, "You're the one responsible, I'm now going to put you in handcuffs and send you to The Hague," was basically saying, "Netanyahu, since you've now destroyed it, the way I'm going to address this problem is to get rid of all the Palestinians and basically reward you for your crimes." So that's the second point. And yeah, it's these two things are mutually exclusive. And I think that's another reason why Netanyahu was so gleeful about this proposal, because he's hoping to use it as a license to derail the further implementation of the ceasefire agreement. You raise an absolutely crucial point about the Arab states. As you may know, during the past 15 or so months, people often sought to contrast Biden with Ronald Reagan, and the incident that they typically present is when Ronald Reagan called the Israeli Prime Minister at the time, Menachem Begin, during the Israeli siege of Beirut, and told him, "I've seen pictures of children burnt to a crisp. This Holocaust has to stop now." And despite Begin being supremely insulted by the words used by Reagan, because of course there's only ever been one victim in the world, and that's Menachem Begin, the bombing stopped within, I think, 36 hours. But that's only part of the story. The reason that Reagan called Begin at the time was not because of the pictures that he has seen, which, of course, unlike the images of the 40 beheaded babies Biden repeatedly referred to, in this case, there were real pictures of real victims of real murder. But what happened actually at the time was that Reagan received a call from his closest Arab ally, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia at the time, Prince Fahd. And Prince Fahd basically told Reagan, "You are putting your Arab allies in an increasingly difficult position. We're beginning to get concerned about the security and stability of our own regimes, of our own rule, if this continues, because Arab public opinion has gone past the boiling point about this, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for us to keep it in check. So, please intervene with our mutual friends in Tel Aviv and get them to stop this." And Reagan got the message, and the next day he called Begin, and the bombing stopped. What you've had during the past year is a completely different situation, where the Arab governments have been completely inert. They have assumed the role of passive spectators at best, while not even withdrawing their ambassadors. You look at the Palestinian Authority and the West Bank. It has continued security cooperation with Israel from the very beginning of this genocide up until today. Egypt and Jordan have done nothing to basically send a clear message that their peace treaties with Israel could be affected by this genocide. The governments that more recently normalized relations with Israel, United Arab Emirates and Morocco and so on, have effectively been cheering Israel on. So, there's been a complete inertia from the Arab states during the past year. And I won't really get into the reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with changes in the region during the past 2 decades, and a genuine fear that if they do anything to satisfy their public opinion, that especially in the aftermath of the Arab upheavals of the past decade, that their publics will then view them as vulnerable to popular demands and start demanding domestic changes and transformations as well. And also, these regimes on the whole have become much more narrowly based, much more brittle, much more dependent on Washington and the West and on Israel than they were in decades past. But I mean, the point I want to make is that I gave you the example of Reagan. Before that, we spoke about how it was primarily the Arab states that nipped this latest Trump proposal in the bud through their direct and public and forceful response. And what that demonstrates, beyond any doubt to me, is that these same governments could have, at any point during the past 15 months, ensured that even someone as passionately and fanatically devoted to Israel as Joe Biden, and there's no comparison, just for the record, his passionate attachment to Israel exceeds by orders of magnitude any attachment that Trump has to Israel. Let's be clear about that. But even him would have been susceptible to Arab pressure, diplomatic pressure, threatening to use the oil weapon, whatever. They at any point during the past 15 months, just as all it would have taken from Biden would have been one phone call to Netanyahu to put an end to this, the Arab states could have used their leverage to bring this to an end and chose not to.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And I want to move to the West Bank. But if you could spend just a short amount of time talking about why Trump values his relationship with the Saudis so much, like why is that the one place they want to normalize relationship with at the expense of, not at the expense is the wrong word, but like just behind Palestinians, like putting them to the side and saying that if they get a normalization deal with Saudi Arabia, all will be dainty. And then if you can analyze what's happening in the West Bank right now, both in terms of Israel's actions and the role of the Palestinian Authority, as we've seen escalations in Jenin, 20 buildings were leveled just the past weekend, and increasing numbers of casualties. But I'm going to pass it back to you to give us your analysis on that and
Sure. Well,
also,
those are two quite separate
separate
topics.
questions.
Yeah. So let's take the first one, Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia is the key Arab state in the region, certainly in terms of its role in world energy markets, certainly in terms of its wealth, its symbolism, because Islam's holiest places, Mecca and Medina, are located within Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia is not only from Washington's perspective, but even more so from Trump and Kushner's commercial transactional perspective, if you will. For them, it's the key Arab state, particularly so at a time of growing US Chinese tensions, where China is now the largest customer for Saudi oil, and is, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, also the largest investor in a foreign investor in Saudi Arabia, and certainly is the source of the highest proportion of Saudi imports from any foreign country. So, as you may remember, in 2020, Trump and Kushner engineered what they grandiloquently
Abraham
called the
Accords.
Abraham Accords, basically normalization accords between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco on the one hand, and Israel on the other. And then it was understood that the real prize, of course, would be Saudi Arabia, because that's when the dam breaks. I mean, these three countries I mentioned are tiddlywinks compared to Saudi Arabia. And Trump lost the election. There's a lot of speculation that if he would have won the election, he probably would have been able to achieve Saudi-Israeli normalization agreement. That's at least what a lot of people believe. I'm not so sure. But then Biden comes in. And the thing to understand about Biden, because we need to focus as much on continuity as we do with change. Biden did not renounce or change a single one of Trump's Middle East policies, whether with respect to Palestine, whether with respect to Western Sahara, whether with respect to Iran, or indeed anything else. And so
Fascinating.
Biden's position was again one of strategic neglect of the Palestinians and of promoting Arab-Israeli normalization, not as leverage to achieve Middle East peace, but as leverage to further marginalize and isolate the Palestinians and leave them exclusively at Israel's mercy, at the mercy of Israeli unilateralism. But the reason it didn't succeed is because this agreement is fundamentally not a Saudi-Israeli normalization agreement, but a bilateral Saudi-American agreement. What do I mean by that? Well, the key elements of this agreement are that the United States would provide Saudi Arabia with a formal security guarantee, with a civilian nuclear program, including enrichment capabilities, and in return, Saudi Arabia would place explicit limits on its commercial and security relationship with China and on its cooperation with Russia, which is the world's largest oil producer, in terms of what is known as the OPEC plus arrangement. Problem here is that these American commitments are not in the gift of the White House. They actually need congressional endorsement. And it wasn't going to get through Congress. And so the whole idea that was first proposed by Trump and then adopted by Biden is if you include Saudi-Israeli normalization as part of this package, then you will have a number of senators who are opposed to an improvement in Saudi-American relations, but who will sign off on this agreement because of Saudi Arabia recognizing Israel and leaving the Palestinians at the mercy of Netanyahu. So the reason this didn't go anywhere is because at the time, Israel was only being required to make a few cosmetic gestures, not even towards the Palestinians, but towards the Palestinian Authority. But given the extremist nature of the Israeli government, and I don't need to get into details here, I think, even that was too much for them. So it was a logjam. And the Biden administration was actually hoping to use this to persuade Netanyahu to ditch his to ditch those coalition partners who are even more to the extreme right than he is, and replace them with more centrist coalition partners. Well, this didn't work for two reasons. First of all, that Netanyahu is on the extreme right of the political spectrum himself. And second of all, that his alternative coalition partners, who would have been willing to go along with these cosmetic gestures to the Palestinian Authority, was not prepared to play that role if it meant the United States giving Saudi Arabia a nuclear program. So that wasn't going to happen either. Then October 7th happened, Israel's genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip commenced, and it became impossible, increasingly difficult for Saudi Arabia to proceed with such an agreement unless there were clearer and more explicit and firmer and more irreversible US-Israeli guarantees of an end to the Israeli occupation, which made it even more impossible for Israel to go along with this. So the Saudis then went to the Americans and they said, look, the Israelis are, have fallen off the planet in terms of fallen off the spectrum. They're just, too crazy to deal with right now. Why don't we do a bilateral US-Saudi agreement in which we agree to limit our relationships with China and Russia, and you give us the formal security guarantee? And Biden said, absolutely no way. If this agreement doesn't serve Israel, there's not going to be an agreement. Now you have Trump. And here is, I think, the difference. On the one hand, Trump may well be willing to go along with the bilateral US-Saudi deal that excludes Israel because of all the benefits it would have to the United States. The question is whether in 2025 Saudi Arabia would still be prepared to do this. I suspect they will because they're important achievements for Saudi Arabia in it as well. And in such a situation, I think, Trump would basically tell the Israelis, you're on your own. We're not going to pressure the Saudis to normalize relations with you. And we're also not going to pressure you to stop annexing West Bank territory. It's all yours. Go ahead. That's the one scenario. The other scenario is that Trump, who is very much motivated by personal animus and achievements and big and shiny objects, may want to prove that in fact he is the one who would have succeeded in this agreement. It's Biden who failed, and perhaps with an eye on a Nobel Peace Prize or whatever, will then go ahead and push for this three-way agreement that includes Saudi Israeli normalization. And the question then becomes, what is the price that Washington is prepared to make Israel pay for such an agreement? And it's in that context that we should understand Netanyahu's statement yesterday about if the Saudis are so eager for a Palestinian state, they should create one in Saudi Arabia.
Yep. Thank you so much for that. And I want to be cognizant of time here, but I'll be remiss if we don't touch on the West Bank. Could you quickly give us your analysis of what's taking place there and how it fits into the broader spectrum of everything that is taking place.
Well, the West Bank is really the core of Israel's interest in the occupied territories. I mean, Israel's annexationist policies have been directed not at the Gaza Strip. You know, the Gaza Strip it has blockaded, put under siege, committed genocide, and all the rest of it. But the territory that Israel wants most to annex and to depopulate is the West Bank, what it calls Judea and Samaria. And in fact, it's already annexed East Jerusalem. It's already annexed parts of the seam, the border zone between Israel and the West Bank. And what you've seen in the past 2, 3 years, beginning actually under the previous Israeli government, is an astronomical expansion of Israeli violence and land grabs and settlement expansion and ethnic cleansing of particular territories, and intensification of apartheid and so on. And what it is now doing is using this permissive environment that has been created by the US and unconditional European support of for Israel since October 2023. Not all European governments, but certainly the European Union and many European governments, to begin basically transferring its practices that it was able to implement with impunity and without any accountability of any kind by its Western sponsors and allies in the Gaza Strip, and began now gradually to transfer these to the West Bank. That's why we've seen so much destruction in Jenin and its refugee camp, in Tul Karim and its refugee camp, in Tubas and the Farah refugee camp. And it's like a spreading ink blot. And the key issue now is whether the United States will endorse a formal Israeli annexation of West Bank territory. And there's several options here. The US could recognize an Israeli claim of sovereignty over the entirety of the West Bank, over what's called Area C, which comprises some 60% of the West Bank, or of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank. And that would create an interesting situation because it was just last year, of course, that the International Court of Justice ruled that Israel's occupation of the territories it conquered in 1967 is illegal and illegitimate and unlawful and needs to come to an end as rapidly as possible. So it's setting up another conflict between the West and civilized norms and values, between the West and international law, between the West and international institutions, between the West and civilized norms of conduct between states.
And lastly, we saw this under Biden. We saw college students across the United States get beat up, get arrested, get shot. You yourself were prevented from speaking at an event at Tufts University. There is an increasing crackdown on pro-Palestinian activism and just free speech in general in that realm as it relates to Palestine. And a lot of movement activist leaders or just people who want to be able to speak about this issue are afraid and trying to decide how to do this, what's the cost of it. And so what advice, if any, do you have for people who are engaged in this space
Well,
and
I'm
are
not sure I have any useful advice, but I would make the following point. Yes, of course, there is a concerted, orchestrated, systematic, very well-organized and well-oiled effort to systematically suppress any speech in support of Palestine or critical of Israel, and particularly critical of Israeli genocide. That's all true. But the re the, there's an there's a broader reason why there's so much effort being invested into stifling pro-Palestinian speech. The reason they're doing this is because those who have a more general agenda of regulating public expression, of curtailing freedom of expression, of curtailing freedom of association and freedom of organization, of crushing any dissent to the state and its policies, recognize that Palestine is not only the canary in the coal mine, but when you attack pro-Palestinian speech, you can actually bring the democratic establishment on board. When you go after, let's say, gay rights or abortion or, some of these other issues, you're dealing with a very polarized elite. When you go after Palestinians, much like, when you used to go after Jews in 19th century or early 20th century Europe, then you've got most of the elite in your pocket. When you go after Palestinians, you're not going to see systematic outrage from Chuck Schumer and the Democratic establishment. It becomes, and then you use Palestine as a battering ram, and once you've established new standards for regulating free speech and crushing dissent on the backs of the Palestinians, then you can use those new standards to swing any way you want. Then you can use them, to go after women's rights, to go after minority rights, to go after gay rights, to go after climate activists, to go after whatever you want. So, these people understand that the way to break a chain is to go after its weakest link. The proper response here is not only to maintain a clear focus on right and wrong, and I'm not in a position to advise people to keep putting their university, their studies, or university careers, or jobs, or whatever, on the line. That's, of course, a very personal decision each individual needs to make. But I would argue that making clear the broader consequences of these efforts, if they succeed, is something that should also be done.
Knowing that, Bani, thank you so much for being on Let's Just Talk, and we look forward to continuing these conversations with you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.